Okay, we're doing this unscripted, unfiltered, sometimes a little clumsy as a result, but here we are. Good to see you, Vinay. Good to see you, Sanjala. So
it's good to be back here.
Yeah, good to have you. Beautiful day.
Beautiful day here.
Enjoyed the farmer's market today, which was awesome.
It's great. I went twice. Got coffee and then I got lunch.
It's getting bigger. Hopefully we're going to do it multiple days of the week.
The whole campus is out there. Everyone's happy to go to that farmer's market.
Everyone's happy, and we are hiring scientific reviewers and inspectors. Job positions are getting posted, so for all the people who love doing science, come on over to the FDA. A little shameless plug.
Great. Well, I have some questions I was hoping we could get into.
There's been
a lot of buzz and kind of questions around. I think we just approved a new vaccine out there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Moderna's new product, mNEXSPIKE. Yes, FDA gave it marketing authorization.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how is that different than existing COVID vaccines?
Moderna had a previous product called SpikeVax, and the difference between SpikeVax and mNEXSPIKE is instead of going after the entire spike protein, they've got two smaller pieces of the spike protein that they've decided to target in their new vaccine formulation, mNEXSPIKE. And the FDA, consistent with what Marty and I were saying in the New England Journal of Medicine, have given them a marketing authorization for 65 and older, and then people at high risk of severe COVID-19 outcomes. And the company has committed to doing the randomized controlled trial, placebo-controlled randomized study that we want them to do.
Love it.
Okay, so just to make sure I got all that.
Yep.
So it's a different product.
It's a different product.
Okay, but for the same disease.
For the same disease, COVID-19, yeah.
And so what does that mean for existing versions of the vaccine? Like, is this just another option for consumers?
Well, I guess Moderna is probably best to tell you what their broader game plan is with these two things. But right now they have two approved products. They have SpikeVax and they have mNEXSPIKE. And I think in the years to come, we will see the direction the company chooses to move in. But what does it mean? I think it means realistically, we're in the summertime right now. I personally don't know too many people who are going out and getting vaccinated right now. There are still a few people, but I don't know too many of them. Mostly people are waiting for what's going to happen in the fall. Very likely we're going to be in a situation where there are at least three companies bringing products to market. Novavax with the product that we approved a few weeks ago, which targets JN1, and then Moderna and Pfizer may target a JN1 sublineage. We'll learn more about that by the fall.
What is JN1?
Good question. So as you know, throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, this virus has been changing. In the beginning, it was extremely lethal, put a lot of people in the hospital. Over time, it evolved in different ways. There was a Delta wave, which was really sort of bad several winters ago. And then finally, it rested on this Omicron subvariants, or JN1, just a fancy way of talking about the genomics and sort of the nature of the virus. And it has really been stuck on this JN1 kind of strain for at least two calendar years now. I mean, that's what the WHO and the FDA said 2 years ago. Think about JN1 and JN1 sublineages like KP2. And again, this year we're saying JN1 and sublineages like LP8.1. So what is it? It's a type of coronavirus, a strain that is the dominant strain that's taken hold of the globe.
Okay. Yeah. And so you mentioned something about the RCT. Can you just unpack that a little bit more? So to approve this drug, we did not require an RCT up front. Is that correct?
Well, the company did do randomized controlled trials, but they tested their new product, mNEXSPIKE, against their older product, SpikeVax. And we at FDA felt that that was sufficient to allow this product to be available to the vulnerable people, older people and high-risk people. But as we have said all along, and we're going to stick to, and they are going to fulfill their commitments, we want to see a randomized controlled trial of people between 50 and 64 who are healthy Americans to show me these vaccines are doing what we hope they're doing and what we think they might be doing, but we don't know for sure. And we want to see that in this age group where there's something what we call global equipoise, means that you look across all the countries in the world, people are genuinely unsure if the vaccines work in that age group. Some countries recommend it, some don't. We want to see proof that it works. And again, they're not going to go up against another Moderna product in this study. It's Moderna vaccine against a saline placebo. We're going to see all the adverse events in this study. We're going to see whether or not it helps people and what it does and whether or not it's working like we think it might be in 2025, you know?
I think a lot of people are going to be interested in the results of that trial because I think it's an honest unknown. It's a scientific unknown. And so when you get into that group that you described, the 50 to 65, I mean, France, you got to be 75 or 80.
80
actually,
in France,
80
yeah.
in France, 75 in the UK,
yeah.
or high risk. I think a lot of clinicians, a lot of moms, a lot of people out there in the world are wondering, does the risk-benefit ratio favor getting it at this point? So I think a lot of people are going to be interested in that results. I mean, let's be honest, the numbers suggest there's either a lot of skepticism, uncertainty, distrust, but 85% of healthcare workers did not get the last COVID shot.
That's right.
And somewhere between 12 and 14% of kids got the last COVID shot. So that means for 87-88% of parents, for 87-88% of kids, their parents said no thank you to the last COVID shot. So I think you're going to answer some really interesting questions.
Yeah,
that
I think
a lot of people
it's such
asking.
A key study. And I think there's another misconception I want to clarify, which is people have said you at FDA are recommending mm-hmm. the shot to high-risk people and older people. I want to be very clear. The FDA is not your doctor. We are not. We don't recommend shots to people. What we do is we make them available for patients to have a conversation with their doctor. But I can understand a 66-year-old who goes to see their doctor, and they may decide to do it or not do it. That's their medical decision. FDA is granting a marketing authorization for that, but we are not in the business of making recommendations. That's other agencies and other bodies. mNEXSPIKE is now available to 65 and up or people at high risk of COVID-19. They're going to run a randomized study in this population where we have genuine uncertainty. And the results of that study and other company studies will be available, I'm optimistic, by the planned dates by the spring and summer of 2026. And then the entire medical community is going to be able to look at those results, and our thinking will evolve. We will learn something that we have not learned in 4+ years, which is what are these vaccines doing in an elegant randomized control trial? Yeah.
I think it's a really good point that the physician-patient relationship is really sacred. And when the government tries to become your doctor, we don't have a great track record.
We do not have a good track record.
And I think some people look to the government and health agencies to adjudicate on every single aspect of their life and lifestyle as it relates to health. We saw that during COVID when the quarantine periods changed. Is it 5 days, 7 days, 10 days? And then when I come out of a quarantine, do I need to wear a mask if I'm vaccinated? And at this time of season, if high risk, low risk, you can't possibly adjudicate on every aspect of American life. And so our job at the FDA is pretty simple. And that is we get applications and we have a mandate from Congress to review the data in those applications and decide whether or not products are safe and effective and for what group.
And you know, that's a really excellent point. I've also heard some people say, why don't you just make it available for everyone 6 months in age and up? And the truth is we have a mandate at FDA, and that's a statutory mandate that we need to have confidence the benefits outweigh the risks. And I cannot in good conscience, and I don't think you can, I don't think any of the reviewers here can, tell a 20-year-old man who's had COVID 4 times and had 3 or 4 or 5 shots that they derive a net health benefit from getting an additional fall booster. If we don't have that confidence, we can't give those marketing authorizations. That's our statutory duty at FDA.
Now, I know this is a kind of a very simple question and probably seems obvious, but I think it's worth unpacking what you mean by benefit risk ratio.
Great point. You know, so I think that all medical products have risks, and some have benefits, and some have benefits that exceed the risks. So what do I mean by that? You know, let's just take something like high blood pressure. High blood pressure can shorten your life. And we have a number of antihypertensive drugs that can lower blood pressure, and many of them have also been shown to lower heart attacks and improve longevity. High blood pressure pills also have side effects. Many people have had trouble with a high blood pressure medication. And we don't give high blood pressure pills to people with normal blood pressure. We give it to certain levels of blood pressure. I know there's a debate about, you know, the specific cutoffs used and some randomized control trials like SPRINT that people are critical of, but depends maybe 140 or 130, 125. They're different high blood pressure values. Above that, we think the benefits are bigger than the risks, but we're not giving a person with 110 systolic a high blood pressure pill, for instance. And similarly, all medical products are the same way. We have cancer drugs we give to people with a certain risk of bad cancer outcomes, but we don't give it to people at lower stage or lower risk. This is true across all aspects of medicine. Statin medications we give to people with a certain LDL cholesterol or higher and cardiovascular risk, but not to people at normal LDL cholesterol and cardiovascular risk. COVID-19 vaccines are thought of, you know, Marty talks about the two camps, this blind booster in perpetuity camp, thinks that everyone should get one in perpetuity. That's not what medicine is. Medicine's always about what's your absolute risk of something, what's the absolute benefit you might derive, and what are the risks that are known and unknown, and what's the balance of this? And we can't answer that for every person out there. That's why there's a doctor for every patient. We just provide marketing authorizations at FDA.
I really like your cancer analogy because that resonates with me, right? Like navigating family members through that, right? You know, going in for these severe stages, there may be some drugs that could work or could not work, but and they your physician explains to you what those trade-offs are. And so this is kind of similar where we're going to be able to get that data.
If somebody has a colon cancer that's removed, they may get adjuvant chemotherapy or several cycles of chemotherapy, but that recommendation is going to be different if they have stage 3 versus stage 2 versus stage 1 colon cancer. Sometimes we'll give two drugs, sometimes we'll give it for 6 months, sometimes we won't give any drugs at all. So we always take into account the risk to the person from the disease, the potential benefit of the medicine, and the harms of the medicine. That's just medicine 101. And I think that's been lost in the COVID discussion because naturally, people have just been piped the message of be fearful, be fearful, be fearful. And it's hard to continue to pipe that message when we've been living with it for 5 years. Most of us have had it several times. Some people say, well, I haven't had it recently. But the truth is, they may not know they've had it. You know, we're not even doing a great job of documenting all the times you've had it. Many people have also received one, if not two, if not three, if not more doses of these products. We just don't know for so many people what the right number of boosters is.
I think we lose that connection sometimes even in tumor board, where you'll see a CAT scan and there'll be a tumor in a certain location and we'll talk about the blood vessel involvement and the sophisticated operation that can be done or the preoperative radiation or the adjuvant therapy. But then the tumor board is over and you go over and meet the patient.
Right.
And you discover a frail old man who is not that interested in treatment and has different life goals. And so, you know, you realize like that disconnect between a hard and fast recommendation versus tailoring a recommendation to an individual based on their physiologic reserve, their interest, their desire, their life goals or ambitions, some people want to live forever and other people feel like, you know, I've had patients tell me I've had a good run and I just don't want to go through all this at this point.
It's so well said. You know, people call it personalized medicine and they talk about genetics and all these omics and molecular therapies. But the truth is medicine has always been personal. If you want to prescribe someone a pill, if you want to do a surgery on them, you have to look them in their eye, you have to lay hands on the person, you have to understand where they're coming from, their values and preferences, and you often get information in the doctor-patient encounter that you don't get from the chart. And nobody thinks medicine can be practiced by the FDA, the government practicing medicine here in White Oak for every single person out there. I think that's part of the mistake here. I think we at FDA have, again, struck a very fair balance. We're making these products available to many, many Americans who are at high risk of these conditions, to the fraction of Americans who are really worried. We're also making the manufacturers generate, I should say, encouraging the manufacturers strongly to generate data so that we can all learn to whom these vaccines should be applied and how many doses we should give.
I think, you know, so from the econ perspective, right, yeah. Thinking about costs, another thing I've been hearing and reading about is, well, you know, based off how we approve things, that determines reimbursement, right? And certain drugs may or may not be covered. But what's interesting is, you know, when it comes to all, you guys know this very well, when it comes to oncology, rare disease treatments, a lot of these therapies are very expensive and are not necessarily covered by many insurance, you know, companies and CMS. So just because of what we do at FDA, right, there's a different jurisdiction with kind of the coverage.
This is a great point. Well, first of all, this man wrote a whole book about the labyrinth processes of healthcare coverage and who pays exactly what. But just to be clear, the FDA also is not allowed to consider cost and to whom the costs are borne in our decisions, but we do have a duty to not approve products when we are not sure the benefits outweigh the risks. That's our duty. And we just can't rubber stamp a blind boosters in perpetuity strategy for the next 10 years. Yeah. you know, Marty says this all the time, that an 8-year-old girl, if she lives till she's 80, should she get 80 boosters in her natural life? We can't rubber stamp that in good conscience. That's not part of the duty of the FDA.
And I sort of hear in your voice that we want to give people the benefit of the doubt, when, especially when you're talking about incurable conditions and disabilities and conditions where there's no other treatment of any type of suffering is terrible. And obviously rare diseases, we want to give people the benefit of the doubt and tailor that regulatory process for the condition being treated. At the same time, we don't want people to have false hope, financial toxicity, have their lives ruined financially, and take something that has known harm. So you can't approve 100% of drugs that come through for these conditions just because these people are dealing with terrible suffering. We have to adjudicate some good judgment to give them the benefit of the doubt and err on the side of giving people both the spirit and the letter of right to try, and at the same time keeping an eye on safety and factoring in other things.
Yeah, well, I mean, you segue to rare disease, so, you know, we're going to have some discussions later this week on that, so I think it'll be good to come back together and talk about, you know, how are we thinking about some of those parameters.
I think it's one of the reasons why we're in this room today, because the cameras, we got a giant camera here, people can't see it, but a few friends we have who are watching, including Bigfoot over there, thanks for being here again. There's a giant camera here, and the reason we're in this room is it was too big to move to our regular spot because there's so much going on at the FDA this week. We have infant formula. We've got the roundtable with cell and gene therapy Thursday. That you're leading.
You're having your first CEO listening tour session.
Our first CEO forum with executives of drug developers. So. A lot going on, and that's why we're here in this room today, which we're not normally in, and we don't have the beautiful background behind us, but we can see it in the distance.
I think you made an interesting point about regulatory flexibility in rare diseases, which is that, you know, we're talking about the COVID-19 vaccine, we're talking about healthy people, we're talking about tens of millions of people, and we're talking about randomized controlled trials. And those things kind of make sense to me. Healthy people taking a novel medical product or a medical product year after year, millions of people affected, you need to do randomized controlled trials. But in the rare disease space, we're talking about sometimes conditions where there's only 40 people with a condition, where we know that if they don't do something now, they have a 50% mortality rate in 2 years, something like that, or they have severe disability. We know that randomized trials are not always feasible, possible, or practical in those situations. And there, of course, we're going to be much more flexible.
Yeah, of course. How can you not have empathy on that group and want to give them some opportunity when they're willing to try, you know, to take some risks for some hope?
Because the risk-benefit ratio is different.
Exactly.
It's different. And it's also unknown sometimes where if we can generally guard against dangerous things, if we can generally guard against that, how can you not want to support that endeavor?
And there too, to be clear, we're still not the doctor. We still don't tell each patient you have to take this product.
That's right.
What we're saying is it's available for you and your doctor to decide if it's right for you. And you can imagine a situation where the doctor says, this is right for you and I believe you ought to give it a try. Also a situation where the patient or doctor says, it's not right for me. And that's, again, not our purview.
So important. And I think, if I remember correctly, your cell and gene therapy roundtable not only have experts and academics and leaders from different sectors, but I think some patients or
patients, friends, and loved ones who have loved ones affected by rare disease.
Didn't you just speak at one of those meetings?
I was this morning. I was at the NORD meeting, which is the rare disease advocacy organization, and I gave a keynote address. Which was a great opportunity to kind of convey our philosophy and our commitment to expediting products for patients with rare
diseases. I'm sure they appreciated that.
They did. I sent them your well wishes. They appreciated that.
It's kind of one of the fun parts of the job I didn't anticipate is you get a chance to circulate, hear so many different perspectives. You know, on this CEO forum sort of national tour, we're asking for big ideas, you know, giant ideas, things that people have always thought, why doesn't the FDA do it this way? We want to hear those ideas, and so bring it on.
For what it's worth, I've been emulating that model internally, too, as I've been meeting with different teams. And so even just this morning, I was chatting with some of our economists, and I said, you know, what are some ideas you have of things you want to try or do differently? And this individual said, I hadn't thought about that. Thank you for asking, and let me get back to you. And so I think it's really exciting that we're starting to really think about these ideas, both internally and externally, to see where we can make an impact.
So this is a point that I think Marty makes and is sometimes underappreciated, which is that the FDA is a terrific place, and there are lots of people with institutional memory who've worked here 10, 20, 30, or even more years. And these people are invaluable because they understand the history of the FDA in ways that, you know, I don't. But at the same time, there's also a value in bringing in new people who don't have that institutional memory, because they inject new ideas. And they sometimes are the first people to say, hey, you've been doing this way for a long time, but why don't you try it a different way? And all great organizations need a mix of the both. You need the people who've been there a long time, but also some new ideas once in a while.
How can you not want to come work here? If you're a scientist out here hanging out with Vinay and Sanjala, you get a couple of those fresh bread sandwiches at the farmer's market. I mean, it is very attractive here. And just so people know, to be clear, we're not hiring scientific reviewers because any were laid off. People took, there's a retirement, normal churn, people leave because people move on to other careers. And so there are always openings. And so we want to encourage people to come to the FDA right now.
I'll give another plug for that, which is that, you know, I've been reading papers for 20 years. You know, 20 years I've been reading. Every year I'm learning something new, a statistical technique I didn't know, or another way in which clinical trials are run that I didn't quite appreciate. In the 4 weeks I've been on this job, I've learned 4x the number of things, because you get access to sort of the deepest level of thinking about how clinical trials are run and how they're analyzed. We have access to a lot of the individual patient level data in these clinical studies. Some of the statistical analyses here are the most elegant I've ever seen. I mean, it's really the pinnacle of what it means to read and understand medical research is working at the FDA.
And you'll have to read a little less because we have AI now.
Transition.
So there's typically like thousands of pages of background information in an application. Yeah. And so the AI is identifying redundancies in the background to say there's multiple papers that say the same thing and summarizing that. And so it is making the job more efficient. So far, I've heard great things from the staff. I think.
When did it debut?
Today is the first full day, I believe.
Yeah.
It launched yesterday. 2,300 scientists and people at the FDA logged on, unique people logged on by 9:30 this morning. I think I got the update. So people are using it, and we're going to keep making it better. You know, it can always benefit from multiple iterations.
And it's more than just for viewers, right? It's, you know, for our investigators to identify high-yield targets.
Yes.
And a lot of different use cases we're going to start unpacking.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, exciting times.
Yeah, great.
I know we have a busy week ahead, so maybe we should land here and check back in towards the end of the week.
You're just back in town from California?
Yeah, I was out in California visiting family.
Sipping wine in Napa?
I don't know. My father-in-law would tell you that maybe the wine is better in Carmel, so that's where we were hanging out.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Good. Welcome back. Good
Thanks.
To have you, although you were kind of working remotely.
I was still working, Marty. Yeah. You don't really give us a break around here.
That's true.
But if you come work here, you will get your
appropriate vacation.
Government allocated days off.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
Yeah.